Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books. My guest is Matt Geiger, whose new collection of humorous essays, Astonishing Tales, is available now wherever your fine books are sold. The subtitle, Your Astonishment May Vary, well, you've been warned by the subtitle is. Matt, someone saw this book sitting on my desk. They remarked that it looked like one of those old porn novels you might see that comes across when you clean your grandfather's house out after the funeral. What's the deal with the model in the front of the book?
That's right. So that's that model is actually my friend, and there's a story all about her in the book, near the front of the book, actually. Her name is Bonnie Logan, and she's 83, and she's, you know, what you might term a quote-unquote little old lady, and I saw her one day many years ago. And a friend said, you should ask her about her life, and I did. And it turned out she was a very famous, very prolific pin-up star and burlesque performer. She actually still performs burlesque sometimes these days from a wheelchair and everything. But she's wonderful. And the point of that story is, like most of the stories in the book, that if you scratch the surface a little bit, if you dig a little bit, if you ask, if you look, you'll find astonishing things all around, because people tend to dismiss and marginalize, you know, you see a quote-unquote little old lady, oh, it's just a little old lady, you don't think anything of it, and she has a remarkable story to tell, and it's fascinating and tragic and inspiring and all the things that a good story is.
Well, and it seems to me, I liken it sometimes to sitting next to a stranger on an airplane. People will tell perfect strangers things they wouldn't tell their best friend. Do you find that when you go out and, you know, you observe something, you just start asking questions? People love to talk.
Yes, they do. And, you know, part of it is the strangeness actually allows you, the familiar is very habitual, right? And so the strangeness allows you to see things better and to hear things better and sometimes to express yourself better. And that's actually, if there is a theme, I mean, these stories are about all sorts of things, about axe throwing and parenting and the aforementioned cover model and all that. But the string that kind of binds them all together is that strangeness. And it's actually, there's a word for it, there's no English word for it, but the Russian word is astronomy. And it's this technique where you disrupt the reader's habitual perception of the world, of ordinary things, and make them strange. And by doing that, the idea is that hopefully you broaden people's vision and let them see the world, see the beauty, see the humor, see the mirth and all that. And that stranger on the train or the plane or whatever, it's the same. You know, that strangeness allows a clarity of vision. And that's actually what I'm trying to get at in all these stories.
Well, one of the stories that did that in particular for me was one about when you took your three-year-old daughter to visit Santa Claus. I thought the story yes. The story was going in one direction, and it went in a completely opposite direction. So yeah. What did you take away from that experience that gave you insight into her three-year-old mind at the time?
Yeah, well, I love writing about either myself as a child or other people as children, and I'm very lucky. She's four now, but she was three when most of the book was written and when that story was written. I have a little daughter, and so everything to them is strange, right? They see everything. You know, you and I, we go through our lives, and we know what a chair looks like, so out of the corner of our eye, we kind of, like, we mark something as a chair, and we sit in it, but we never really look at it. But little kids look at everything, so they're wonderful characters to have in stories. And that one in particular is about a few things. It's about the time I took my daughter to see Santa Claus. And I, the topic of weight comes up because Santa is known for his kind of portly stature. I lost a bunch of weight because I was trying to get healthy because I'm a dad now and all this and that and everything. And it doesn't suit me. I look better fat than skinny.
I think you look sick.
Right. Like an emaciated, sallow-faced Santa Claus, I think, is what I wrote in that story. So I lost all this weight and waited for people to congratulate me. And then everyone I know came up to me with this terribly worried look on their face and kind of went, are you okay? And I live in Wisconsin. So, I mean, the primary diet here is cheese and beer. So it was not hard to lose a little bit of weight. It just cut out some of those things. But it didn't suit me. And so I kind of regained the weight so that people would stop asking me if I was sick. And when I am bigger, I do look a little Santa-ish, maybe hopefully like a young Santa. And then, so what I started thinking about, because people make that comment from time to time, with my big beard and my belly and all that, was what Santa actually is. And mythologies are a big deal to me. I write about mythologies a lot in this book, and I think mythologies are really important. And people, if you're a parent, you get this question from people. They say, like, oh, what are you going to tell your kids about Santa? Like, are you going to tell them A or B, you know? Are you going to tell them that story or not, basically? And I think mythologies are really important for helping us understand the world. I think we're a narrative species in the same way that a giraffe is a long-necked species and a cheetah is a fast species. I think we're a story species, and I think those mythologies are important. And I think we're in those mythologies, and I think we tell them. And that's what Santa is to me. And when I had a daughter and I started thinking about the Santa story and telling her the Santa story, I thought about the meaning of that in the language we use to tell those stories. And without giving away the end of that particular story, that's what that's about.
All right. Your name, Matt Geiger, you wouldn't think that that's a common name, but you open the book and talk about that, the travesty of growing up in the shadow of
yes.
Matt Geiger, the NBA player. How did that affect you?
You know, it's funny. That is, I do have an uncommon name. So when you have an uncommon name, you get very excited when you find that, oh my gosh, someone else has my name. And we tend to think of our names as being part of us. But a name is, you aren't a name. You know, when I die, nothing will happen to my name. The name is a marker. It's a symbol for something. And so to those of us who have uncommon names, or at least uncommon names in this part of the world, it's always this kind of gleeful surprise and shock. Oh, someone has the same name as me. So when I was a kid, someone named Matt Geiger, the same name as me, the same spelling as me, was drafted into the NBA. And throughout the rest of my younger days, once in a while he'd come up. And I follow sports, and so I kind of followed his career. And once in a while I'd get a little joke about, oh, are you the NBA player? Because obviously I'm not athletic enough to do anything. But then when my first book came out a few years ago, my publisher had me sign up for Google Alerts whenever the name Matt Geiger is mentioned in the media. And basically it's been 3 years of getting a little ding on my phone and then receiving an article about the other Matt Geiger. So some of them are really interesting, and then some of them are terrible, and it's the Internet, right? So just some of it is ridiculous. And I get caught up. I've never met him, but I get really caught up in it because he shares my name. And, you know, someone will say something awful about him, and it'll really upset me. And, of course, he lived a much more exciting life than me. He's a professional athlete, and he did all the things that entails, right? He had a shark tank in his Florida mansion, and he had some tax problems, and the county wouldn't let him build a helicopter pad for his private helicopter, et cetera, et cetera. But I get, you know, I get these dings. It's this, like, you know, Matt Geiger, you know, owes, you know, half in back taxes. And for a second I go, oh, no, you know. and that's what that story is about. It's about identity.
Well, I saw this happen in the last couple of months. There was a fellow on Twitter whose name was Brett Kavanaugh, and he was taking a whole rash of crap on Twitter during the hearings. He said it's a bad day to have this name. So we do see this, but I would think Brett Kavanaugh is a more common name than Matt Geiger.
Yeah, I only know of the other one, and I did try to contact him. He never got back to me. And I did years ago, before I started this Matt Geiger story started germinating, a magazine contacted me, and they wanted to hire me to do a story about, they were doing a story all about people all over the country, quote-unquote ordinary people with the same names as celebrities. So like a George Clooney and a John Depp and all these, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That is a thing, and obviously your parents don't know when they name you, but it can actually, it won't affect your conversations with close friends and family, but every new person who meets you, the first thing they'll think of if your name is George Clooney or whatever is the actor, and then they'll have to kind of go, and also this George Clooney. And that's, identity is a strange thing. It's something we grapple with individually and as a society, and that's just part of it.
These essays in this book, they're not particularly long. I mean, I've read books of humorous essays before, and they're usually much longer. You've really, you're shortened yours down to the bare essentials. How do you do that as far as an editing process? Just taking out the boring stuff?
Yeah, I did. So I was reading, I shouldn't take all the credit for that. I had a really mean-spirited editor this time around, which is the best thing anyone can have. They cut. But I was reading, the whole time I wrote this book, I was reading Chekhov, who is really funny, and incidentally uses Ostrogony all the time and makes things, normal things, weird and helps you see the world better. There are these great Russian authors that we're all familiar with, whether we've read them or not. You know, when you think of Tolstoy with these enormous books, and you think of Dostoevsky with these enormous books, and then you think of Chekhov, and they're equal, but some of his stories are a page. I mean, he's in my mind, kind of the first writer of flash fiction. And the whole time I was reading him while writing this, I just kept thinking about the fact that you can cut, you know, he was a doctor, and he had that kind of surgical idea about writing, and you could cut straight to the heart of the matter. You could go right there. You didn't have to dance around it. I'm certainly not comparing myself to any of those Russian authors who were incredibly talented and insightful, but I tried to do that same thing, to get right at the things I wanted to write about and show. And I'm not trying to tell anyone anything. I'm just trying to show them things. So I'm not trying to tell you that things are funny or beautiful. But I'm trying to just show you the humor and the beauty and then let you decide for yourself, which is part of the reason for the subtitle of the book, Your Astonishment May Vary, because, of course, personal taste will have some impact on that.
Well, it seems like this whole concept of astronomy, even though there's no English word for it, that seems to be the basis of a lot of humor I see. Because I'm thinking as I'm talking to you, Saturday Night Live skits do that all the time, where they'll think it's going in one direction and they'll do it something else. So is that, I mean, it's one of those things that's not obvious to us until you point it out, but then once you point it out, we recognize it in a lot of places in life.
Yeah, in fact, that's a very astute of you, I think. And that is, it's my, once I learned the term, and I read it in an essay about Chekhov, actually, I realized that was most of the time when I was laughing at something, I was laughing at that. And, you know, the Norwegian author Knausgaard, he uses this beautiful example where he says, you go on vacation and you go away from your house for 2 weeks or something, right? And when you come back, everything in your house has what he calls the faint shimmer of strangeness. It makes things beautiful, it makes you see things, and it makes things really funny if you come back to ordinary things through a slightly different route, be it language or perception. It's funny. Things are funny. Things are weird and funny and beautiful, and I'm not trying to take away from the fact that the world also seems to be in flames and terrible in many ways, but that doesn't detract from all the humor and beauty around us as well.
Well, and I guess I see that in life. I mean, I'll see relatives that I haven't seen for a while and think, God, you've aged since I saw you. But we text a lot, but I guess it is sort of the same concept, right?
It certainly is. And that's one thing when it happens with someone else. It's another when sometimes it happens to yourself. Sometimes you don't actually look at yourself for a year or something. You know, you glance in the mirror or whatever to make sure you don't have something on your face. Or you'll see a picture of yourself and go, oh, I like many people, I still think I'm a child, right? So when I see myself, I see this man with his own child and his family and his job, and I'm shocked. I'm aghast. I'm amazed. Once you know that idea, the strangeness idea, you'll see it. Yeah, you'll see it on Saturday Night Live. You'll see it in David Sedaris. You'll see it. You'll see it in Catherine Newman a lot, who's one of the funniest writers in the country, certainly. You'll see it in Bill Bryson quite a bit.
No.
You'll see it all over the place.
George Carlin was also a master at it, too.
Yes.
But your personality as a kid growing up, were you class clown, class geek? Where'd you fit in?
I was certainly a buffoon of sorts. I was interested in things, but not in the things that were being taught. So I was certainly a disruptive kid. I was probably picked on quite a bit. I don't know. I was I was not particularly interesting as a kid, I don't think, but I was particularly interested in things, just not the things that were being taught in class. But I certainly, I'm sure if any of my old teachers were on here, they'd say I was a bit of a class clown, yes.
So you were making your observations even as far back as then, right?
Certainly, certainly, and I was, I'm not even sure I'm all that insightful now. I certainly wasn't all that insightful back then. You know, that's the thing, whether it's Socrates or whoever, that as we get older, we don't know more. We just start to learn that there's more to know. And the thing that's amazing about youth is that it's interesting, actually. So I have a very young daughter, and little kids know that they don't know anything. There's actually a story in my first book where I was in college once, I was talking to a little kid, and I kept asking him questions just to be polite because we were at a social gathering, and I thought that's what you do. And at some point, he just stopped me, and he said, you know, I'm only 4. I don't really know much yet. Like, you can stop grilling me on all these things, you know? Like, and that's really beautiful. But then once you hit, I don't know, become a tween maybe, or once you're 12 or something, there comes a 15-year period in which you think you know everything, which is natural and normal, but also demonstrably false.
Yeah.
And then as you get a little older, you start to realize how little you know and how much there is to know. That's where I am right now, and I enjoy it very much. I like throwing up my hands and admitting, oh, I have no idea, but isn't that amazing? But when you're young, you tend to think you know everything. So I probably wasn't, I didn't see things as well because I thought I knew more than I knew.
When I was in high school, the Cats in the Cradle song, the Harry Chapin version, was popular. And I liked it, probably for not the reasons that older people like it. But that song's had some meaning to you in your life, right?
Yeah, it certainly does. So that song was covered by a band called Ugly Kid Joe when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Ugly Kid Joe was like a pop metal band, and they were like the musical equivalent of Garbage Pail Kids or something. They were just, you know, they certainly weren't the type of band that you would imagine having this very touching ballad about fatherhood and being present for your children. But they covered that song. And I don't remember exactly how old I was. I think it's in the book because I checked the dates. But I was so moved by it because this song, for anyone who doesn't know, and it's been covered many times, but, you know, it's about this dad who's just not there. And, you know, he's always away on business, and the kid just kind of grows up without him. And toward the end, there's this kind of ironic turning of the tables where the dad's this doddering old man. You imagine him kind of lonely, and then, oh, guess what? His grown son doesn't have time for him. And if you had told me when I was 10 or whatever, when you grow up, be present for your kid and be there for your loved ones. You know, don't neglect them lest they should, you know, neglect you when you get older. I would have rolled my eyes as any kid does and said, yeah, sure, whatever. But that song really spoke to me and it stuck with me. And it has certainly shaped my fatherhood. I have literally left important meetings at work because my toddler daughter at the time, you know, got a hold of the phone and called me. And it just said something ridiculous and like she wanted to make pancakes or something. And I just said to everyone, I have to go. Something more important has come up. And I went home and made pancakes with her. And I don't want to get fired or anything, but I think that's good. I think that pop metal song had a good lasting effect on me and probably many other people.
It's always amazing where our inspirations come from. So,
yeah.
All right, this book is Astonishing Tales, Stories and Essays. Your Astonishment May Vary is the warning on the front cover of the book, but it's just a fantastically funny, and it's smart humor. I mean, that's how I take it. Anyways, by Matt Geiger. Matt, thanks for joining us today to talk about your fantastic book.
Thank you so much for having me.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakalskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.
I started a joke. bitch started the whole world crying.